Welcome to the Adam Madden Podcast, episode 76, a podcast for IT professionals. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm John.
And I'm Jerry.
In this show, we answer citizens' questions.
We read and comment on your feedback.
And we talk about consolidating services. So without further ado, let's get on with the show.
So we asked our listeners if they wanted some questions answered. So we had about three people get in contact. Was it mainly for our Telegram group we did this, John?
Yeah, it was. Because I wasn't really sure what the timescales were going to be until our next recording. And I thought, well, I'll put the question in there and then see what turns up. And if we didn't get many responses, then I'd open it up a bit wider. So this is just a little plug. If you want to get your questions through to us, you can always email the show. The contact details we'll give you at the end. Or you can join our Telegram group.
Which is getting very catty at the moment as well. I think we've got like 30 people in there now.
Yeah, it's not too bad at all, actually.
Interesting discussions.
Quite the little community now.
Yeah, very much so. So yeah, so I just said if anyone had any questions they wanted to ask, to sort of feel free to put them forwards and we'll make our way through them. So the first response we got was from one of our Telegram group members called Meaty. We don't know his full name or his real name, but Meaty's a perfectly good handle to have.
Could be Meatloaf.
It could be Meatloaf. God, I did wonder what he did after Anything for Love and Bat Out of Hell. Anyway, so he says, he or they say, first a touch about my background to add some context. I work as a team lead and sysadmin in education on a fairly large Windows network. Low budget, high demand, and besides some legal stuff, and contrary to what all the teachers and admin staff believe, no overly urgent requirements. We have an old, mostly unchanging network, but due to the nature of teaching, many departments change up their location and or software, which is often cheap, poorly made, and has incredibly specific requirement on a termly or yearly basis. Lots of last minute, this is urgent, do it now stuff. So he's said, in order to make our lives easier, I'm beginning to embrace more automation. We've got the big stuff out of the way, but to proceed, we're looking into using lots of custom PowerShell scripts for a lot of this, given the random requirements and poor quality of our software. We've run into a small issue, but I'm not sure where the best practice and most practical solution is. We often need to run scripts overnight. So far, we've run them off a random server that also does other things during the day, hosts a few end-user applications, but we know that there's a better way. What is it? Dedicated server? Does something exist that will manage this for us instead of using Task Scheduler on a 2016 box? So, Al, you do a lot more Windows stuff than I do.
Yeah. Okay, so we're talk about running PowerShell scripts to do stuff, automating it.
Can I suggest something? I know I'm not a Windows guy, but I have used Ansible on Windows. I am an Ansible guy, so I know it's definitely doable. And all you're really doing is running PowerShell scripts within a kind of framework that is Ansible. And it seems fairly mature. It works with, it speaks to the WinRM interface. And that will the great thing with Ansible is you can start simple and sort of build up what you need. So yeah, I would, if I was plonked in a school and had to start managing their stuff, I would seriously look at Ansible. It depends if Meaty is a Windows guy or a Linux guy. Really, the controller machine has to be Linux, or I think you can. I've actually seen it. People running it on WSL, subsystem for Linux.
Yeah, that's a good idea, actually. So I would actually take that step further forwards from that. One of the things that I've been doing quite a lot recently is using Ansible Tower. And, well, not Ansible Tower, I've been using the open source upstream for Ansible Tower, which AWX. Is a project called AWX. Mm. So I've actually got a Vagrant machine with the install scripts in my Git repository, which I'll add into the show notes. And that will stand up Ansible Tower and a GitLab environment. So one of the nice things about Ansible Tower is that effectively Ansible Tower becomes your scheduler and your credential keeper. So if you have credentials that you need to store to use WinRM, you can provide those through Ansible Tower. you can have your job scheduler in Ansible Tower, and you can also have a notification system. So it means that from an administration perspective, rather than logging into a VM to see whether or not, sorry, into a server to see whether or not your task scheduler jobs have run successfully, it might actually just be easier to bring up a web page and see whether your task's completed that way.
There's the GUI side as well, isn't there? Yeah.
Yeah. But like you said, it's just basically Ansible. And as you said, you can start small and build up from there. So if you have got lots of PowerShell scripts, one of the things you can be doing is using the GitLab instances on that machine to version control your GitLab's, your PowerShell scripts, and also have an Ansible job to refresh the PowerShell scripts on all the machines they need to go to, and then run the PowerShell tasks on those machines.
Or you could even parameterize the scripts in Ansible, but that's getting a bit more complicated.
Yeah, that's true.
That's not so simple. Well, it's simple enough, but it's maybe not as simple to start off with.
Can I ask, is that the tower which Red Hat is now did, or they purchased, or OpenStore?
So Red Hat purchased Ansible as a company, and Ansible were selling Ansible Tower as a commercial product to fund the development of Ansible Engine, I think it was they call it, which is what we refer to as Ansible. When Red Hat bought them, they still have the commercial offering, which is Ansible Tower, which you can pay a subscription fee for. But if you want to just experiment with it to see how it works, AWX is a good sort of intermediate step between the open source Ansible and the licensed product Ansible Tower.
A colleague of mine at the last place I was working was saying that, I mean, often with configuration management, you have a problem, or you have the desire to run it from a single, only one machine runs the config management rather than you running it from your own machine. And Ansible Tower is a good way of doing that.
And it also means that you've got a single pane of glass that says whether your job's all ran successfully. It's all API driven. So if you wanted to script something to, you know, pull down when the last job was run, update your inventory, all those sorts of things, you can do all that with Ansible Tower. So it's quite neat. Is there anything else that we've missed on the Windows side of things? Because obviously we're both quite Linux focused.
No, that sounds good. I mean, I haven't done any PowerShell running with Ansible, but that sounds like a good idea. It sounds like you get a nice web interface with that, and then you can see what's happening. So have a centralized server with AWX on it, and then get that to push out your PowerShell scripts to the remote host.
The one thing that I will say is that the VM that I had set up for doing AWX and GitLab is quite a meaty bill, quite a meaty box that it needs to be. I think it's something like 4 to 8 gig of RAM you need to give it, and you need to have 2 CPUs because it's all running in Docker. So GitLab's particularly heavy. If you can separate out the two roles, that's probably better. But this was just a VM that I spun up to do sort of a demo for colleagues on what Ansible Tower looked like. But it worked reasonably well for just, you know, ad hoc testing of Ansible Tower as well. So that was so from the Windows only world, you might also want to look at things like, I think it's SCCM.
Yeah.
Is that something sensible? Can that do jobs like that?
Yeah, System Center. That's a really good product, but it's very in-depth, but it's expensive. But if you're a charity, a school or whatever, you should be able to get that quite cheaply. And it's done per license. So normally by clients, you'd have to have you buy an agreement with Microsoft. So if you've got a Windows license agreement with Microsoft as a school, normally you kind of get that all in a bundle. So it might be looking at doing that.
So one of the other things that I think probably thinking about it more sells the Ansible side of things is something else that I kind of skipped over in the background blurb, which is that one of the other things that they're starting to do now is actually manage some of the other infrastructure that's becoming digitized, such as boilers, CCTV access control and stuff like that. So actually, as long as you've got either an SSH interface or a web API access into those boxes, Ansible can do something with it. It might not necessarily be quite as clean and smooth as sort of general Ansible, but there's some options there to you. So that was the first question that Meaty asked. The other question was, we deal with a lot of sensitive data across a lot of systems involving many different types of person, students, staff, parents, visitors, etc. We know that if an incident breach occurs and we need to investigate, we'll be on the phone to an expensive third party to come and investigate for us, as we don't know what to look for, where to find it. We need some kind of centralized logging which we can deploy in time. For now, though, what are the essentials to enable and where can we find them, e.g. logging in AD?
So there's two things here which you need to look at, is auditing and centralizing your logs. What you need to do is, there's a thing called auditing on the domain controllers where it basically logs everything what happens. So it logs on, it logs things like password. People trying to log on, it would tell you if they're logging successfully or if you've got a bad password, or someone's trying, or if it's failed login attempts. But obviously you'd have to search through those logs to find what those logs are. That's one thing, which obviously logging what people logging onto the server or whatever, or logging onto desktop or whatever, that would get logged on the domain controller. But the other thing about it is like auditing. If you've got things like people deleting files and stuff from a file server, or someone changing things like a permissions to AD groups, none of those things are enabled by default in AD due to the amount of storage space you're going to get logging. So I'll put some links in the show notes of what you need to do to enable those. They will basically put all the logs onto local event viewer, but then you need some sort of tool to either pull them back to a central location. I don't know what about open source tools you can get, but you can get tools like Logarithm, and there's some Quest tools out there which will basically pull them all into one place to do that. I don't know what sort of centralized logging tools you can get for Linux or whatever. So they will pull the Windows logs of Windows events into a central location.
There is Logstash. What was it? Logstash Elasticsearch. There's a load of tools which are written by Elastic, which ship the logs from the sort of end clients, if you like, to the centralized logging store. And I think I remember seeing there's a Windows tool to do that.
Yeah, I just had a quick look. The one that you're talking about is called WinLogBeat, which is basically an agent that captures the logs and ships them to your Elk stack, your Elasticsearch Logstash and Kibana instance. The tool that I've seen used when you don't want to have the complexity of running an Elk stack, but you've got a syslog collector, is a tool called Snare. And Snare basically turns Windows event logs into syslog. So anything that will capture syslogs can capture Windows event logs using Snare. Now, Snare is not free. It's a product you can buy. So I think you've got lots of different options there, just depending on how you want to work with it, really.
In terms of incidents and breaches, I would say that having good version backups is also very important. I think one of the most prevalent attacks today is ransomware attacks, where basically all your data gets encrypted and you have to pay to get it unencrypted. If you've got version backups, that completely goes away, because you can just restore from the last backup. And another thing is that your workstations, if you like, and your servers need to be thought of as disposable as possible. So the data lives somewhere else and gets backed up and all that stuff, and then the servers can be rebuilt if they need to be, or just re-imaged or whatever.
I think that pretty much covers off Meaty's questions. As always, if any of our listeners have got any other suggestions we've missed, or if there's anything else that you think we should have mentioned that we didn't, please do feel free to get in touch with us, and we can either pass your comments on, or we can talk about them in a future episode. Yeah, thinking about the incident and breach stuff on top of your digital controls, something that's probably quite important is making sure that you've got encryption at rest enabled. So on all of your Windows machines, try and get BitLocker switched on if you can. BitLocker is a thing that you basically have to put a password in on boot, and that then encrypts the contents of the disks when it doesn't have that password on. It's a very rudimentary form of protection in case of theft of the device, and it also means that if a member of staff leaves staff with a device, effectively the first time it tries to talk back to the AD, you can effectively disable the machine. Now, I've not done a lot with BitLocker, but that's one thing you can look at. Typically from the open source side, there's a couple of tools. Linux comes with a product called Lux, L-U-K-S, which is the Linux... No, I can't remember what it stands for. It's basically, it's a disk repartitioning tool, and it then can layer encryption on top of that. And it's used for when you build a, say, for example, an Ubuntu server, and it asks if you want to encrypt your drive. It's using Lux for that. If you want to go with a separate product, there are tools like Veracrypt, which work with both Windows and Linux, Mac as well. The downside that I found with using Veracrypt with Windows is that, particularly with Windows 10, is that when you do the updates that come out every quarter, there's no Veracrypt device driver in the build image. So it goes to do the update and it can't see the OS drive. So I would be tempted to say that if you're an entirely Windows estate, try and use BitLocker. If you are a merged estate, there are other products that are out there that might be more applicable to you. I've worked with a couple of vendors as well in the past, Gemalto being the main one that is coming to mind, but they're very, very expensive. So the nice thing about the Gemalto product, though, is that on boot, it actually, provided you have static IP addresses, on boot it will talk to your Gemalto key secure server, and it will actually confirm the boot, the machine is valid to boot. And if it isn't valid to boot, then it won't boot. But in those instances, you actually don't need to put a password in, because if the key server is offline, then your box is offline. So if you've got lots of servers that you're managing, not so much the client workstations, then you might want to look at the Gemalto product. But again, as I said, that's a very expensive option.
Yeah, so I've had experience with both using McAfee's and disk encryption and BitLocker, because BitLocker uses a TPM module inside your laptop. If not, you have to put a code in every time. So yeah, I think that's quite good for another show. I think if we go into the details of how all that works, how the AD stores all the recovery keys and everything. What's the next question we've got on the list?
So next one's from listener Andy, who says, is there an affordable way to image Windows desktops that is less insanely complex than Microsoft's deployment thing? I've already had a few suggestions here on Telegram, but perhaps other listeners face the same challenge. So I think we need to establish what is Microsoft's insanely complex deployment thing. Is it SCCM?
No, there's a thing called MDT, which is something deployment toolkit, and SCCM goes on top of that if you want to use SCCM to get it. What you have got to remember is that you have to have a volume license key to even image a Windows machine. So if you've got a Windows 10 laptop and you haven't got a volume license key, it's just an OEM, you technically can have it, but a little license agreement where you're meant to have a volume license key to do anything regarding imaging that device and then pushing it out to another device. MDT is free, and what you do is you basically install it on one machine and then you build it how you want it. You then I can't remember if you sysprep it or not, or the tool sysprep. A couple of years since I've done it. And you basically do a Pixie boot, and it basically saps the image onto your MDT server. And then what you can do is you can then write scripts and stuff to basically push that image out to the laptops using Pixie boot or PXE boot, whatever it's called. And you can then, if you want to, you can add extra drivers in it, so if it's like a new drivers. But it's a bit of a beefy tool. I think it took me about a week to set it up for a client about 2 years ago. But once you've got it, it takes a bit of leg room to do it. But once you've got it working, it works quite nice because obviously you've got that, what do you call it, stability, where like you can just, you know what it's going to be like when you run it out.
So what is SysPrep? I think I know what it is, but for the benefit of listeners that might not.
Basically, it means it used to be regarding the SID, which is like each laptop would have, or each device would have a security identifier, which is generated. And if you clone that, if you clone a laptop or whatever, a desktop, it would have the same SID. And that's a bad thing because every SID is meant to be different. So what it does is SysPrep, it basically seals the box up and resets that SID. So when it first time it boots, it generates a new SID for that device.
Cool. So it's basically making it like a generic image. Yeah. Okay. And the other thing was Pixie. We probably talked about that in the past, but might be worth going over again.
Yes, that's basically just like, it's like if you can separate Windows by sticking a CD in or a USB stick and then booting it up and then doing the install from the CD. What you can do is that, I know with like on DHCP on your network, it's one of the options. You can say this is what the Pixie server is. If I haven't got an operating system, it's normally like F12 or F11. You press that and it will basically point you to the Pixie boot server, and that will basically download like a little image to your machine, which you can then boot off from. And there's like if you're installing it from the USB CD-ROM.
Yeah, no, I've used it quite a lot with my last job, so. There's also the slightly different, which is UEFI Pixie booting, which is all good fun.
The next question we had was from listener Stuart. And listener Stuart has a slightly different question for us. He says, imagine that AWS, GCP and Azure all fall off the face of the planet overnight, and you're now faced with either choosing smaller providers with probably a much smaller feature set or moving back to on-premises. In that situation, what would you choose? If the former, how would you deal with the limitations? Would you mix and match workloads across multiple providers, or would you stick with one or two and work with the limitations? And if it's the latter, that's moving back to on-prem, would your workflow and choice of infrastructure change based on how you work with the cloud now? Would you steer more towards hyper-converged and or private cloud in a box solutions, or would it be VMware, KVM, Hyper-V with config management, or just revert to how it was pre-cloud days? I suppose, in a sense, it's partly a question about reliance on the big clouds, but also how you think on-prem has improved, if at all, to keep up with the cloud providers. This is a very interesting question. So, firstly, the scenario you describe, whilst it's theoretically possible, I think the chance of having 70-something data centers all vanish overnight would be pretty fundamental. For starters, how would we get to watch things like Netflix?
I think if they'd all dropped off the face of the planet, we'd have bigger problems.
True. But I understand that the question that's being asked is not so much really what do you do if all of those cloud providers go offline, but what really happens if the one that you've chosen suddenly has a major incident. Personally, I think I would probably end up doing a combination of the two, moving to smaller providers, perhaps somebody like DigitalOcean or someone like that.
Well, I was just thinking about that. Would DigitalOcean be one of those ones that's left? Because because the thing about DigitalOcean is they're simple. They don't have the things like the sort of more complex things, maybe like auto-scaling groups, I don't know, key stores, things like that. But that's something that you could implement in DigitalOcean, and using a cloud provider who's, in my opinion, the defining feature of a cloud provider is an API that you can talk to. So as long as that your smaller provider had an API, a kind of self-service thing where you could spin up virtual machines effectively, or even Docker containers or something like that, you could emulate the services that the bigger cloud providers offer.
Yeah, I think that's fundamentally kind of the key for me, is that basically what AWS started out as was the outgrowth of what Amazon were using internally themselves to manage their servers and services. So everything that they're running in cloud in AWS is effectively stuff that you could be creating and running yourself. The difference that they have is that they've got the scale to be able to do it for a much lower price. So realistically speaking, I think if the big three cloud providers vanished overnight, I think it wouldn't be long until at least one or two other cloud providers rushed to fill that void. Tools like OpenStack make it theoretically possible for other smaller providers to provide a cloud service based on established API sets. But, I mean, that doesn't really answer the question. Would you change the way that you work? Probably not. Most of the direction that travel's going in these days anyway is towards sort of Docker-based services or Kubernetes-based services. Now, not everything's based on that, but, you know, if you are not using... I think actually probably the more interesting question is less about Docker and Kubernetes and stuff like that, but actually more like Lambda, so the serverless side of things. I think realistically, once people have moved into using stuff that is effectively just one shot, you know, Python or Golang or, you know, Ruby scripts that basically fire up for long enough to run a task and then die again, I think that's going to be a harder state to come back from, because there's not really, frankly, anyone with some effort, anyone can stand up a Docker cluster of, you know, 3, 5, 10, 30 nodes, which for most moderate-sized companies is probably sufficient for at least getting started. But the Lambda stuff is, I'm not seeing open source implementations of something like that yet. I don't know about you, Jerry, if you think...
Not really, though. Although in a sense that is just spinning up a Docker container and running that code inside a container, that's all a Lambda function really is. It's interesting because, the two things that sprung to mind with me, for the last year or so, my last job, I was working with all on-prem stuff, no cloud stuff, and I was coming from a sort of cloud mindset. So thinking about things like disposable infrastructure, where the cattle versus pets, as we've talked about in the past. And I was looking at ways of getting this sort of cobbled together on-prem infrastructure into that kind of workflow, spinning up a VM and making sure that was on, you know, scale, that put onto a box that had more capacity available and things like that. So I kind of thought a lot about that and didn't really come to any real conclusions, or couldn't really put anything into practice as it happened, but it did make me think in those directions. And the other thing was that a lot of the tooling that's grown up around the cloud stuff would still exist if the big three cloud providers did suddenly fall offline. So you'd have something of the ability to build that missing infrastructure just because the tooling now exists and it didn't in the past. Quite an interesting perspective on it as well, I think.
The other thing that I think is quite interesting is that the traditional on-prem virtualization product that most people sort of used up until cloud was significantly a thing was VMware. Mm. And actually, VMware are making their own play in the cloud world with being able to run VMware NSXT in AWS, for example. And there's no reason why if you were looking at a way of improving your on-prem workflow, so you needed to have the bulk of your workload on-prem, but every now and then you ran out of capacity and resource, there's no reason why you couldn't scale up to the cloud using VMware on AWS, or potentially, if AWS was to go away, VMware on Azure or VMware on DigitalOcean or whatever.
Or just a load of VMs that you could, someone gives you.
True.
Not VMs, sorry, dedicated servers. VMware has that REST API as well, so it's fairly easy to get going with just poking HTTP requests at VMware ESX, I think, or vSphere.
ESXi.
One other thing to mention in that respect is Overt, which is it does a similar thing for KVM. It kind of gives you like a management interface and an API that you can start using to build clusters of machines which run virtual machines.
From my point of view, I deal with a lot of both on-prem and in the cloud. I would say my thing is still 50-50 between doing stuff in the cloud and doing stuff on-prem. So it's not going away anywhere. I mean, I'm studying for my VMware 6.7 at the moment, NXX and vSAN, and my normal VMware. So it's not going anywhere. I mean, there's still lots of corporates out there and governments where you can't put stuff in the cloud at the moment still. So yeah, I think it's still out there. And again, and if I had the choice of if I was running my own IT team, I would definitely do automation with everything. I would be using scripts and everything, or whatever, or Ansible to bring up, or Terraform to bring up a VM, and then use Ansible to configure it.
So there you have it. That's our view. So I think from the on-prem side of things, I think Al's right. It's not that it's going to go away anytime soon. What you are tending to see, certainly where I am, is a lot of people looking at how they do things on-prem and looking to move that sort of lock, stock and barrel to the cloud, which is not necessarily the right way of doing things. But by moving things to the cloud, what you're realistically doing is taking the first step on an automation process. You may not realize that's what you're doing, but that is effectively what you're doing. So if you are moving towards doing stuff in a more automated fashion, then even if you move everything back to your local on-prem, so say, for example, going back to the question before about provisioning machines using something like PXE and stuff like that, there's no reason why you can't get yourself back to a cloud-like state using the provisioning tools you've got and something like Pixie Boots and stuff like that. Anyway, so on top of the Q&A questions that we've had from our audience, we've also had a little bit of feedback from some of our listeners. So the first one we got was from a listener called David. And David writes, "Thank you for your podcast. In episode 75, you asked about tools to check whether a web page had changed. You might like to try Silas Brown's web check program." And he provides a link to that. Now, this confused me a bit because actually a team that I used to work for had written their own internal product for monitoring when servers were down called WebCheck. So I was expecting that the code that he was linking me to was actually something we'd written inside the company I work for. So that was a bit confusing to start with. But actually having had a look at it, it looks like it's a simple Python script that literally just connects to a web page and tells you if things have changed. Have either of you come across this product before?
No.
I haven't, no.
It's in the feedback. So if anyone wants to go and look for a product to... it says, WebCheck is a program to check web pages for changes to specific phrases of text. Some web monitoring programs and watchlist facilities, etc. will tell you when any change is made to a page. But that's of limited use when you're interested in only a few specific phrases, especially when these are surrounded by many other items which change far more frequently than the one that actually interests you. So WebCheck lets you check for changes to a particular item on a page. This is not a foolproof method. If a page lists old news or otherwise incorporates an old version of the item you're monitoring, WebCheck might fail to spot the new situation. And effectively, yeah, it's just a list statement of things to look for.
I mean, I can think of ways of doing it using monitoring systems that you might have set up already. You know, you could do something like curling and storing the response from a web page and then comparing it to the last time you did that. So basically diffing the response and then alerting if there's a difference.
So I think the interesting thing about WebCheck is that it's designed to evolve slightly beyond that. So that diffing statement assumes that the rest of the content in the page is static, whereas WebCheck seems to look for specific sections of the sections of the page. So anyway, It's something that if you're looking for a situation where you're keeping updated with things like that, that's probably quite an interesting thing to go and look at.
It also looks like you could probably integrate WebCheck into a monitoring system as well, just looking at this.
Yes. So we then had some more feedback, this time from producer Dave.
Hi, Dave.
Hello, Dave.
Hi, Dave.
Hey, chaps. Just wanted to say thanks for a fantastic episode 75. Al. Modesty gets the better of me there. I've got to be honest, a lot of what you guys talk about goes over my head, as I've never used Selenium, Terraform, Ansible, etc. But I still enjoy listening because I can often pick up some utter gems. This time around, I've managed to fall in love, wrong podcast, with SyncThing and DigitalOcean. I've heard much talk about SyncThing on interwebs, but it wasn't until I heard about it on this episode and actually looked into it more that I realised how powerful it actually is. I'm currently using it to perform a one-way backup of key folders on my phone and tablet to my laptop, but I also have a two-way sync, kind of like a Dropbox or Nextcloud shared folder in place, so that I can transfer files to my phone seamlessly. Having heard about Al's experience of spinning up a Nextcloud instance on a $5 DigitalOcean droplet, I decided to do the same as a test and ended up shifting over to it permanently. All I had to do was spin up the droplet, snap install Nextcloud, enter some information, run a single command to apply a Let's Encrypt certificate, and that was it. 5 minutes, tops. And moving all my stuff between instances was really straightforward too, so thanks for the confidence to make the move, Al. At the moment, I have three VPSs costing over £36 per month that I could quite easily replace with a number of DO droplets. A $5 droplet with backup plus VAT is just under £6, so I could theoretically spin up six $5 droplets or fewer if I spin a $10 one up, which I might do for some of the smaller services I'm running, but I don't think I'll need that many, which will save me money in the long run. Win! Again, thanks for a great episode and congratulations on the audio quality. You should give your producer a pay rise. Hashtag just saying.
Yeah, I think we should give him a double pay rise.
We'll think about that, Dave.
What he'd originally got.
Yeah. I mean, you do a good job, but, you know, a pay rise? Really? Already? It's only been, what is it, 2 years since you take... No, anyway. So it's a bit weird, actually, because a couple of days before we got this email from Dave about SyncThing, I actually ended up talking to a couple of other people about testing using SyncThing in a much more automated fashion. So actually making it part of a build. There's still a lot of stuff to go into that. So I don't know where that's going to go or if I'm even going to get a chance to have a look at that. But yeah, SyncThing's, there was a period pretty much just before I started looking at Nextcloud when everyone was raving about SyncThing, and then it dropped off because OwnCloud and Nextcloud kind of crept up and took the limelight. Mm. But I'm definitely feeling like SyncThing is actually, it's because of the fact that it does kind of the NAT busting by default. Mm. It does the local discovery by default. You're not having to do lots of complicated configuration steps. It's actually really quite powerful.
Yeah, I mean, previous place I was working, I think they wanted to set up Nextcloud, or there was a movement to set up Nextcloud, and I was suggesting SyncThing because it would just be a lot simpler. Just for so this was for sharing files like binaries and so on that you wouldn't store in Git in a secure way. We ended up going with Nextcloud, but I do think the SyncThing would have been easier and possibly more resilient and robust and so on.
So the last piece of feedback we got was from Jason, who's one of the presenters on the Iron Sysadmin podcast.
Hi, guys.
Hi, guys. And he mentioned that he was recently listening to Admin 75 and says, I'm behind a bit, which is interesting because we're only recording 76 at the moment. Thanks very much, guys. And he says, tell Al to take a look at webinject.pl. Works great with monitoring systems like Nagios, Isinga, etc. for monitoring versions of software. Used it for years to let me know when updates come out for things I can't just add a yum repo for. And then adds a slightly smiley face. So again, I mean, there's lots of ways of skinning the cat of looking at web content. Because HTML is a relatively well-structured language, if you can look for things like specific div tags and stuff like that, then actually you can just use XML parsers to find content on a page. But yeah, so fundamentally, there's lots of ways of skinning that same cat. And WebCheck, they're all more or less doing the same thing. They're just looking for sections of text in a page and seeing if they've updated themselves. So thank you very much, Jason. It's very good of you. Astute listeners may have noticed that we appear to have lost an Al partway through this recording. Al's actually off on site with a customer and at a customer's deployment. And so he's actually ended up getting stuck with something else that's happened there. And so we've actually lost him from the network. This is therefore turning into a slightly shorter show than we were expecting, especially as the last topic we were hoping to get a little bit more input from Al on that one, but never mind. So one of the things that, although we asked for Q&A from the audience, sometimes I have little questions that go off in my head as well. And I could use your help with this one, Jerry.
So what's your question, John?
So it's an interesting one. So I'm involved in lug.org.uk, which I might have mentioned in the past, which is the hosting service for Linux user groups in the UK. And this is kind of an organically grown environment. So it started out as one virtual machine hosting DNS, email, mailing lists, and web servers, web content, and then turned into a very sharded set of virtual machines, each with its own sort of unique security posture and stance. And it's now moved on to a hosting platform where we've got several virtual machines across several hypervisors. One of the problems that we have with that, because it was originally an x86 build, and x86 is slowly dying out in the Linux world, is that our hosting provider has said, I'm happy for you to keep running x86 for as long as you want, but all the guidance we're getting is move off of x86 as soon as you can. So one of the things that I've proposed to the team is that we actually start shrinking stuff down so that we don't have a separate machine for DNS. We don't have a separate machine for mail. We don't have a separate machine for mailing lists. And we've currently got two machines for web traffic for various reasons. And I was wondering if you've got any suggestions on how you might consider doing that kind of collapsing down of functions, if you've got any ideas at all.
Collapsing from a load of machines to a smaller number of machines?
To one or two machines with a fresh OS build, but transitioning the configs of the various different services to that one or two machines.
I mean, coming from the sort of cloud world, I'll be tempted to decouple as much as possible rather than consolidate. I don't know if that's through any logical thing or whether that's just the way it tends to be done in the sort of cloud world. In terms of if you're migrating a website, it's easy enough to just save the configs if you haven't already, take the opportunity to sort of template the configs. I know that lug.org.uk is using Ansible because you shared the GitHub repo a while back.
So ironically, that was written in advance of this conversation,
right?
Because what we were looking to do was I was looking to be able to automate things like security patches and stuff like that because we've got five machines. And actually, part of the reason we're looking to consolidate down is so that we don't have to apply patches to a large number of machines when actually this set of functions could just be performed on one machine.
Okay. But you could still split out the configs so that, you know, that you have, you know, probably a web server database and a load of code which needs to be deployed. So that stuff could be separated and configured separately. I suppose the whole thing with having a single stack machine is you might end up one bit of server software, for instance, the MySQL, the configuration might end up treading on some other bit of configuration, which is why you decouple things generally. But I mean, if you have a site, you've generally got a load of code and a database to worry about. So it's a case of making sure that stuff is exported somewhere, backed up or whatever. And then you can basically nuke the underlying infrastructure or rebuild it and then bung the content back on there, assuming you have a good way of doing that using backup software. I use Restic for that personally, mm-hmm. to back up the web content and database and then restore it onto completely different servers. And that seems to work pretty well.
So one of the things that I was sort of thinking about doing with this kind of, because of the fact we almost get to sort of do a reset and start again with this, was actually looking to using something like Docker on that single node, so that each lug has its own web service instance effectively, so that they've still got their own security containment and they've got the control over their own environment. Because one of the things that lug.org.uk has got is we're very short on person time to actually administrate the service. And we're quite short on, it's not so much expertise, but there's not the time to invest in confirming that we've got everything nailed down and working exactly the way we want it to.
Although if you could look into writing tests for the infrastructure, in which case you only have to do that once.
Mm, true.
And then if anyone does any updates, the tests have to pass. And so they know if the updates are good, then the tests pass and the sites are still served and so on. So
yeah, true.
It's going well. I would go towards that more cloudy way of thinking, but that's because that's just the way how I've been working for the last 3 or 4 years or so. So it's always my first instinct. I don't know if it's the best way. Listeners might have other ideas.
So, say for example, you were to move to sort of that more of that Docker style model, would you? I don't really understand how you get from. Because I still think of things to a certain extent as being, you know, you connect to a machine, whether that's virtualized or physical, but you connect to a listening service on something like Nginx or something like that, and that then translates that request to a static resource or a dynamic resource on the machine. I don't understand really how those pieces glue together in the Docker world.
It's got its own internal networking, which I don't particularly understand myself, but it's, you can basically link the containers together and reference them by name. And in its simplest form, something like Docker Compose will sort out the sort of DNS concerns and so on, so that the containers can talk to each other. That's only really for sort of simple, kind of single app type applications, if you like. Anything more complicated than that, you're starting to get into the realms of Kubernetes, which, if you're sort of spare time poor, that's not a good way to go, because it's really, really complicated.
Right.
I think I'm tempted to say like maybe a server or a VM for each lug, and then they can chop that up into Docker containers or whatever.
See, the problem is that a lug typically has got a set of static content for the web server that they have SFTP access to.
Right.
Then they've typically got a mailing list, which they've got admin access to the interface, but they don't have access to the content sort of underneath that. That's all administrated by lug.org.uk.
Right.
And then they've got a series of mail aliases. So there's very little kind of moving content. We used to provide database services and stuff like that, but actually we had quite a bad exploit a few years ago that took out all the hosting, and the administrators at the time got quite reticent to have too much in the way of dynamic content because of the fact they didn't have the security isolation between each of the lugs
to
be able to provide that database style service.
I think I'd be tempted to decouple the lugs as far as possible, and you could provide separate VMs. I mean, you could get a dedicated server fairly cheap and then run VMs.
It's all donated to us. It's all donated stuff to us. So okay. we receive service from an ISP, from a colo provider,
right,
who provides the VM hardware that we sit on to us. So
okay.
It makes it a bit tricky to start saying, you know, we want 12 VMs and or 24 VMs or whatever.
I suppose in that sense, Docker would be better for slicing up a machine, just because you can it kind of dynamically uses what's available in that way. Whereas a VM is just like, right, I need this much memory and this much sort of promise of a CPU. Maybe Docker would be the way to go there.
Right. Well, thank you very much for that guidance. It's very helpful.
A bit vague though, but maybe some help.
So if any of our listeners have got any suggestions on kind of how I can attack that particular conundrum, please feel free to contact us. Thank you very much. So with that, I think we've got to the end of another fantastic episode of the Admin Admin podcast. So,
yay!
I'd like to thank our producer, Dave. We mentioned him in our feedback, but I just want to express once again a note of extensive thanks for the work that he does on this podcast, particularly this one, which is going to be challenging for all sorts of reasons, but we'll leave that to Dave.
We are slave drivers.
We are indeed. And I think we should give him a raise. I think, do you know what? I think we should give him a 200% raise.
Yeah.
What do you reckon, guys?
Yeah, 200%? That's fine by me.
Okay. Fantastic. Okay. So thank you very much, Dave. You work wonders and thank you so much.
Speaking of Dave, he's also one of our patrons, which I was going to mention next.
Goodness me.
So he actually pays us.
oh, fantastic. Dave, you need to pay for your own pay rise, mate. Sorry.
Make it as big as you like.
yeah, go for it.
So in addition to Dave, just kidding, Dave, we have Mike, Yannick and Armo. Thanks, guys. That's brilliant.
It really helps. Thank you very much, guys. We have an event coming up in the near future. So on Saturday, October 19th and Sunday, October 20th, in Manchester is OggCamp at oggcamp.org. Tickets are currently available and are pay what you want from free with a recommended donation of £15.
I actually got my ticket now and accommodation. So
fantastic.
See you there.
Yep. Me and Jerry are sharing a room. A flat, aren't we?
So yeah, not a room, I hope.
whereas, as I only live about sort of 30 minutes away, I will be travelling in by train each day. So, yeah, it'd be good to see some of our listeners there. And if you aren't aware of what OggCamp is, have a look on the website. There's a video on there, and it's a really great event. And we actually, I joined this podcast in part because of the fact that I was at OggCamp, and so were these guys. So, you never know when one of us is mortally wounded in a, you know, duel to the death. You might end up being a co-host on this podcast. wouldn't that be good for you?
Yeah. As always, welcome to our new listeners. I think the downloads are steadily increasing every month, so which means there's more sets of ears listening to our waffling. So, hello to everyone.
Hello.
It's really good that you're here. Thank you very much for coming along. If it's something that you like, please do let us know that you're enjoying the show, or if you're not enjoying the show, letting us know what it is we're doing wrong, because, you know, let's be honest, everyone makes mistakes, and maybe the mistake we're making is making this podcast. So if that is the case, let us know. Now, you might be asking yourself, where exactly do you go to let us know, Al?
Yeah, you can go to the admadminpodcast.co.uk, and that's got all our contact information on there, including our Telegram link to our Telegram group and all our social medias.
Indeed.
I want to give a shout out to the Iron Sys Admin podcast, because they gave one to us in their last episode. So hello, guys, if you're listening. I think it's Jason. He's working his way through our back catalogue. He said he'd listened to episode 75 recently, which he seemed to think was a long time ago. Maybe he meant to say 57. I'm not sure. Anyway, hi, guys.
Yeah, hi guys. Thank you very much for listening and for commenting on our recent episode. It was awesome of you.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, then we'll see you all soon.
See you later, guys.
Bye.
Cheers, bye. Now it's over.